some songs.
Stories.
Oh, stories, huh?
Yeah.
Oh.
What's your full name?
Bob. Oh, it's Robert J. Klein. Bob Klein.
Bob Klein. It's K-L-E-I-N?
K-L-E-I-N.
How long have you lived in Parsons?
Oh, since 73. August of 73.
What brought you here then?
Oh, having worked in long term in the ministry and switching into drug rehabilitation, into private consultant work, and wanting to get out of Erie, Pennsylvania, big city life, wanting to get do something different. Of course, my wife is from here, so I suggested we come back to West Virginia.
Did she like that idea?
I'm not so sure. I think I liked it more coming back than she. I think so. But she likes it here. Yeah.
How long have you been employed with Appalachian Mental Health?
Since August of 78. Yeah.
Did you open this center here then?
No, this center has been open for, oh gosh. It must have been open probably for 3 or 4 years before that. We were down on the main street, and one of the co-workers, Leonauts, was the oldest member, I think, in this area working. And they had one other staff person. And then I came in, and after that, the staff person who's in charge left to go somewhere else in 78. It was vacant for maybe 3 or 4 months, something like that. And I took it in August of 78.
So this is going on, this is 7.5 years almost for you.
Yeah.
What kinds of problems have you dealt with in Tucker County? If you could generalize a little bit, what kinds of mental anguish do people here suffer from?
I would say most people that I have worked with would classify themselves as individuals who have problems with nerves and depression, feelings of sadness. Those would be the two primary ones. Now, I ran the whole gamut when I first started, from children all the way through to the grave. And it's been, let's see, since maybe 4 years ago that I shifted out of the children's program because we hired somebody. And then I'm dealing primarily only with adults now. But
so people suffer from nerves and from depression?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I
would
say,
well, people suffer from a lot of anxiety. In terms of the nervousness, they feel on edge. They can't understand what's happening. They may, you know, we could switch it over and say some people really are having problems with separation anxiety. Some individuals are having problems on the job. They may be unhappy with their work. They may not like where they're working. Like I had several minors who really didn't like what they were doing, but the options for employment were nothing else, and they dreaded going down into the mines. Now, I would reclassify that, you know, using diagnostic criteria differently, but to them it was a matter they were just having a case of nerves. And so a sense of apprehension, fear, and dread, but aware that this was the only position or these were the only jobs that were open for them and going back into them, something like that.
So the causes of these things are what? A lack of employment opportunities?
I think the opportunities for employment, for going anywhere, for advancement, they're not here. Well, not in their entirety, they're not here. People, I think, are working at jobs in which some of them are probably more capable than the position offers them. People are working like in the mines where they, I think if there were other jobs, they wouldn't be working there. So some of the, you call it stress, some of the stress that they're into is related basically to the type of employment or the lack of employment that they might have.
Does this stress produce, or is it accompanied by a lot of alcoholism and drug abuse, or
well,
how do people express it?
I think a lot of the men express it with the abuse of alcohol. Although there are all kinds of reports going around now, you know, that there's more use of cocaine. My guess is historically after alcohol you'd have marijuana. I mean, I work with clients who you knew that they were smoking all the time or most of the time, and some of them were even selling it, they even grew it. And these would be people down at the lower, you know, say the lower economic levels would be into selling, maybe growing a little bit of marijuana and selling it. But most of them would, I think, express it through drinking, and most of it would be beer. I'm only going from my experience, you know, and I certainly haven't worked with the majority of people in Tucker County, but my impression would be that the men would express it in terms of alcohol, and you probably might have a need to prove themselves macho in terms of probably of some affairs, infidelity, things like that. I don't know what the statistics would be for Tucker County in terms of marriage and divorce, but I would say that's probably a high rate of divorce. Probably they also show it, I think, in terms of physical abuse. Some of the women with whom I have worked, and I think some of the women we are seeing, other staff people would be seeing, fit that battered wife syndrome. You know, they have been abused, and whether it's because this is what they've learned to expect, their role in society or what, but or sense of helplessness or not being able, feeling they're able to get out of it, leave it. But I think that's a way, those would be a few ways that probably the stress would be shown.
So it sounds like there's a fair amount of sort of social isolation among people. What's the word I want? Anxiety, loneliness, poor self-esteem, all these things.
Well, I don't know whether I don't know whether they're as the individuals themselves are as much concerned about it as some of us might be. I mean, it's how to put that. There's a kind of like resignation or fatalism to the area in which people, after a while, learn to accept that life is difficult and life is rough, and if they can't get what they want, they tend to adjust downward. Those who don't end up with a lot of acting out behavior, let's say, or they leave the communities and then may come back, or they never come back, or they may come back for retiring. But there's isolation in the sense that the family is the key to dealing with your own needs. You rely on your family, and the family tends also to help you take care of everything. Like I will get referrals from people who will, instead of the individual coming in, somebody will bring them in who will be a family member. And like I have helped someone, and then they will bring somebody else with them, and they'll take the time to explain to that person, it just happened today to me, that you can trust this person because they helped me. And so it's like they try to deal with it within the family. When they can't do that, they might then reach out. I think the other way they would show it also would probably in medical problems. I imagine that people, I don't know what the doctor schedules would be in Tucker County in terms of how many times they see a given individual or what they would be treated for, but I would guess that a lot of individuals are getting medications of, say, anti-anxiety and or anti-depression medications from doctors in the community, you know, because they tend to look at something as having a physical root to it, And if you're ill, you know, if you have the nerves and you can find a physical thing to it, then it helps you to, it's acceptable. See, where mental illness is still not too acceptable here. Something like that.
Can we jump to November 4th and tell me what you, some of your images that linger in your mind about that day?
Well, I guess on the 4th, Mary Alice and I were called to go over to her school to open up a release center. That was about 6 o'clock at night, and we didn't really know what was going on. I mean, I had left work at 5, she had left work at 5. We had sat down to have dinner, and we were just kind of like relaxing. And we just assumed that when they called us that they were talking about water rising, that we were just talking about, you know, a few people being, evacuating a few people along the river. And I don't think we even really thought, or at least I didn't even think much about, I left my house unlocked, I left all the lights on. I just assumed I was taking her up there to open up a center and coming back home. And then all of a sudden we, you know, the firemen were moving around. We were the only two there. So that wasn't the idea, like you could leave and go anywhere. So it wasn't until probably as the evening wore on and people were coming in to the center and the firemen were there stranded on the side and they had their communication equipment with them, that I began to realize that something really, you know, heavy was going on. And it was kind of like a sense of being, not believing it, that this could, up here in the mountains, this high up, that something like this could be taking place, because we've had high waters here in town before. But I wasn't even beginning to believe that. But it was raining so hard, though, on the roof of the building of the school, that's all you heard was this rain coming down constantly. And the thought I was having was, wouldn't it be, if it only stopped raining, you could see what was going on. But we were so, there were only two of us, and as a result, we didn't know what we were doing. And people were coming in, and we were opening up a kitchen, trying to get some food, and we had no electricity, we had no heat. We found some candles. I had one flashlight in the car. I mean, we were not prepared, and certainly, you know, the schools were not equipped for this. We had emergency lighting from batteries in the gymnasium where we stayed with the people. And then those went out by morning. The batteries just burned out. But it wasn't probably until when I went out in the middle of the night and it stopped raining, I could still hear the roaring of the waters. And I got the impression that the waters must have been very high. But I still didn't even have any, you know, I my mind didn't even think about Parsons. I mean, I accept that I'd heard the firemen talk about Holly Meadows and there was a fire truck down there, but we weren't getting any communication about Parsons itself. And so I had no idea what was going on until finally, like in the morning, I heard that the bridge was out, or it was rumored that the bridge was out. And it wasn't a bridge, but it was the river creating a new channel. But I think it was just a sense of disbelief. But the other thing about it, you were busy helping other people. So I don't really know what I was thinking at the time, you know, other than trying to figure out what the dickens to do, how we were going to see. We had no heat in the building. We had no place for them to sleep. We were pulling mats together. The firemen brought back, scrounged around and got a few mats. We didn't have that many people there because the impression that I was getting that night was that, my first impression was it must not have been all that bad because we weren't getting a lot of people at the center. We only had up to maybe 6, 8, 10, 12, probably a few more. Some of them were miners who were coming off the mountain and they lived in Beverly and they couldn't get across. They tried to go down and the roads were blocked because of the high water. I keep losing my train of thought since the flood. That's one thing that has happened to me. I tend to go block out, my mind blocks out, kind of like an after effect of it. But I was so involved over there on the other side, and for a couple of days, that I didn't even think about my center, to be honest with you. I never even thought that would be underwater. Had no idea of it. Even when I was hearing about the waters coming in the following day into Parsons and the town was being flooded, I don't know why. The last thought I had was at his office. And I think it was a day and a half, maybe 2 days after the flood, I crawled across the opening there in the highway where they had the other side of Black Fork Bridge. There was a tree limb there and an old water hose, and I came through town, I had my car, and I crawled down over and got across and walked across to come across to see the community, and I was really, it was hard to believe. Well, first, of course, coming up, first thing I saw coming down was the nursery bottom. I couldn't believe it. I mean, when I came out of Hamrick, I didn't even, the last thing I wanted to do, I guess, was to go into Hamrick and look, or to go into Hamilton. I mean, I was heading into Parsons. I wanted to see what was going on and check on things, the house and so on. And when I came up to the bridge, it was the weirdest feeling. I mean, I knew my house was safe because my house is on a hill. And I mean, it would have to, risen 200 feet almost to get to my house. But there was a strange feeling of, I was on this side of the bridge. I couldn't get across. This was Tuesday morning. I couldn't get across. And it was a strange feeling that even though I knew my house was all right, I couldn't get to it. It was almost as if I'd lost it. And I couldn't get across. That's it now. I'm trying to recall. So I, not being able to get across that first morning, I just went back because my wife and I were still the only two people up at that center, as far as I can remember, with some help from the firemen trying to keep things going. And I know what I was saying, that what we discovered afterwards was the people on that side of the River Hamilton and Hendricks were being taken in by relatives and families. That's why we didn't have a lot of people coming up to the school, which I think was different from this side, from the Parsons side. There were so many people who may not have been related or to others or had no places to go. They were ultimately, they were moved into the Parsons school. That was what I wanted to say. But it was just a feeling of numbness because I saw the nursery bottom and it was gone. The beautiful nursery bottom and all the trees, and it looked like a gravel pit, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, my God, all these jobs lost, and what are people going to do? And then the following day I got across, crawled down over and went through town, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It looked like pictures that, a couple months before there was a big flood or something in Louisiana or Mississippi, and you saw all these houses, and it looked worse than that. It was hard to believe that really had happened, and I just walked around town, and I didn't feel like walking. I mean, I didn't feel like snooping, it was like...
You felt like an intruder?
Yeah, I felt like an intruder in my own property, in my own town, my own town. It just felt like you shouldn't be looking, you saw all this devastation and you felt like you shouldn't be looking, you should be getting on with it or something. And I got up to my house and then I went down to the office and found that it had, been in under like about a foot and a half of water and so on. Then I tried to open up, I try to be available here, but all the phones were out. There was a feeling of almost like you were non-existent. There was no phone service. You couldn't get, I think the military, when they did come in, had one phone. But everything was out, And then when I was on this side of the creek, there was a feeling that my wife was on the other, and how was I going to get back? It was a weird feeling of separation. But again, for me, I went back over, and then I was so involved with trying to get that with her, trying to help her on the Hamrick thing, that I literally forgot about Parsons for maybe 3-4 days. And then when I did come back, I came back through Sugar Lands, drove my car back down around and came here, and then I'd drive back over to the school, maybe make 2 trips a day to see how things were going there because she was short-staffed. And I found out then, that all these other things were going on over here. Also, I had two staff people affected by the flood, Gloria and Leah. Well, three, in Verda up in Hamilton, but two of them were up at the school here, so I knew that if there were any persons who needed to be seen or who needed to talk to anybody, there'd be staff there. But there was nobody on the other side of the river at that time to work with people, so I went back over there. And I think we were over there for probably about a week before we could come home and sleep. But I have a feeling of almost numbness. I still do at times, or disbelief that this has occurred. But also a sense of, I have really good feelings about the people. I do remember now that practically the next day after the flood, they were bringing equipment off the mountain, local contractors, and there were contractors on this side who were trying to get something straightened out in town. And I thought that was great, but that to me that was just typical of the people here. They just, back to this kind of like resignation, fatalism, you know, it's there it is, you don't wait for somebody to help you, go ahead and do it and help each other. And a tremendous sense of these people are going to do it, you know, they're going to put themselves back into it. Of course, then there was all the governmental stuff that had came in, and there was trying to spend time sorting out where everything was and who was doing what, when, and how, and trying to get other people to get in contact with others, you know. I also felt helpless, a sense of helplessness. It was like what, in the typical role of the mental health person, okay, they weren't looking for you. Oh, I got a few contacts that somebody was having desperate feelings at that time, you know, and you would have to talk to them. But the basic needs were the basic, right at the bottom, you know, shelter, food, clothing. And after I left the hammock to come down here, I really felt almost like a sense of worthlessness. Because up there I felt I was helping to meet some of these needs. So I'd go up in the evening then after I finished here and work the shift in the evening at the center in terms of food distribution and things like that, because I felt that's where it was, and letting people know where they could go and where they could be. But it was a sense like that my work didn't, as it, you know, was designed to do in terms of mental health, did not meet these basic needs that had to be met at this time. Now, in retrospect, these are the needs that should be met and probably are the main needs that still need to be met now. And I did not anticipate a rise or a sudden increase in response to mental health. I still don't. Part of it's because of the way people are. They deal with things themselves, and mental health in a rural area tends to be more crisis-oriented, or you get heavier. When it comes, it comes, you know? And it's not like you're sitting down generally and talking to a couple who want to resolve some marital difficulties, or you're talking to just some minor school problem. It's usually the extreme. And so people tend to wait until they really feel an extreme situation before they come. Now, how people will be in the next month or two.
But the flood itself was a terrible crisis.
Yeah, the flood was a terrible crisis, but it dealt with the basics of survival, of food and clothing and shelter. And that's what they were looking for, see, and that's what they wanted, and that's what hopefully they were getting. Now, afterwards, however, I don't know whether they will respond to the traditional kind of setup, you know, coming to mental health office or not. And that might be partly ameliorated by the fact that we've got some people now who are out there, you know, outreach workers walking around, talking to people, helping them deal with these basic concerns and just talking with them. See? That might have an effect. I've always felt that would be more primary need, but I don't really know. I've never been through a disaster before. Honestly, I haven't. I mean, of this, any kind of magnitude. But my guess from working with people here is that they deal with these things. They just deal with them. And they go on. And I think it's good that they do. You know, I mean, the government could only do so much. And what it does is usually, for most people, late. And there are still people looking for trailers and things like that. And I remember talking to an elderly gentleman whose house was washed away down in St. George, and he had found a place to stay in the down at the 4-H, no, what is it, 4-H camp, the YMCA camp. And it wasn't the best of places, but it was shelter. And I think some of these the federal people couldn't understand why he would be then wanting something else like a trailer right away, because he had a place to stay. But they didn't seem to be able to grasp. I think there was city people, they didn't seem to grasp that this fellow was living in, he had enough resiliency at his, even at his age, he was up in his 70s, I think, to be able to provide a place for himself. It was not adequate, but he had enough sense to do that. You know, where maybe in a big city, if there had been a flood, there had been a lot of people standing in line looking for other people to do something. Now, there may have been that up here in Parsons. I don't know that, but I'm just saying that people have an ability to be resilient. They'll go for help, but if they don't get it, they'll find a way. Now, I want them to have help, see what I mean? And I think they deserve a lot of help to rebuild. But what I'm saying is they would go on, see?
You mentioned families a while ago. Family members have taken each other in. There's been a lot of doubling up, crowding up, and crowded conditions in homes now going on 2 months. Would you foresee that this would produce problems?
Oh, I think it will. I mean, I think it's going to produce all kinds of stress. And I know some families who are trying to get out, trying to move out faster and like they don't want trailers, but they're waiting. They were going to wait till spring to get to start their houses, and now they're working on them earlier. But what I guess I don't want to imply that there aren't any problems. I mean that they're not going to be coming into the mental health to talk about the stress that we're having because we've got four families in this house. They won't do it. What they'll do is they'll deal with it themselves somehow or other. And they'll, if they can talk to somebody in an informal way out there about it, and just others are aware that that's what's going on, they'll deal with it, see? They'll work on it. But I think there's a lot of stress, but I have to be careful. I don't mean to say that there isn't a lot of stress. I mean that we will not see it in the official category of mental health, people coming in, increased caseload. Now, maybe after this builds up some more, you know, where you have two or three families and they can't get out, and where there might be some situations where children living in with other children, a couple families mixed in, there'll be some school problems, and we may be picking up on some of these. I would still say that historically people do not, in this area, respond to traditional mental health.
So do you have less business now than you had before the flood?
No, it's there was a lull, of course. We didn't open our office probably for 2 or 3 weeks in terms of people coming here. And then even when we were here, it was dead because naturally there's no communication. We were here when there were no telephone lines. We were trying to be somewhere so somebody could reach us if they wanted to, like the state or the sheriff or something like that. But it's back to where it was in terms of the caseload is picking up again, but I'm not picking up any cases that I would see as specific to the flood. I'm picking up cases that are what I call traditional, people who have not been affected by the flood in the terms of losing employment or things like this. These are problems they had before, and maybe they've been heightened by something else. Now, I can't speak for any other staff person here, but my caseload is not. There have been a couple cases that have opened up that may be related in the sense that the person has had a behavior that they've expressed before, but having been spared the flood, or maybe having had a relative affected by the flood, this is kind of like awakened in this, almost like a sense of guilt, that maybe, you know, this flood affected my parents, and they were good folk. I have this behavior which is bad, quote unquote. Therefore, something must be wrong, and so I've had a couple responses like that. Not that the person's wanting to change the behavior, as much as they want to just talk about their feelings. So, but not. I haven't seen, and I'd say what we'll see. I don't know that yet. I haven't seen anybody yet with severe depression in this facility as related to the flood. Not that there aren't. See, my guess would be that it's either medical doctor first. See the family, of course. Deal with it. Go to the medical doctor, maybe even go to the hospital, probably in Elkins, contact a doctor, get some medication. The doctor would certainly recommend that they come and talk, but they won't. They don't. Some of them might. So there were I think it would be fascinating to check with the medical professions to see if there's an increase in the levels of anxiety and antidepressive medications prescriptions being made in this area, or in the Parsons area.
Do you know if this